The very first experience, mystical experience that I can remember was when I must have been less than 1 year old. And I remember this experience even right now, just exactly the way it happened at that time. And you'll understand it from my explanation of the inner bodies of man. The body of the soul doesn't reincarnate. It goes on. It's an immortal body. And it develops a physical body around it each incarnation until it has gone through all of the experiences of this earth. Some mystics say that after that it goes on to other planets. And others say that after that it dissolves into its own essence, into the self itself. When I was about 1 year old, or maybe about 9 months old, I can remember just vividly, I was laying in my crib, and I was a full-grown body, as tall as I am now, and it had a beautiful, gorgeous yellow robe on, and I was full-grown body looking at this little child there. And then I was the little body, the little child, fully conscious of this very, very tall being standing over it, looking at it. And this went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Later, I realized in remembering it that that was the body of the soul, which was actually bigger in a sense and more mature than the small physical body of the child that would later grow up, and the soul would inhabit that body when both got the same size, so to speak, which finally happened in a tremendous spiritual experience in Denver, Colorado, when I was about 30 years of age. And right after that particular experience, then I founded all the work that's going today. The second experience was when I was about 7 years of age. And I discovered the area of the mind that worries. And I'd be worrying, we lived in the mountains. I'd be worrying whether we'd get stuck in the snow and I wouldn't get home to hear my radio program. And then I'd be going over in my mind what happened the last time and what I would be missing and what I'd miss if I didn't hear it and had to wait until the next day. They had these radio serials, you know, Captain Midnight and Lone Ranger and all of those, Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. And so I was living in that area of the mind that always worries. Anybody been there? Well, I was there. And I didn't like it. So I said to myself, you're all right now. We haven't gotten stuck in the snow yet, have we? I'd say no. And I actually saw, right at that early age, I saw my awareness come back out of the future right to now. Then I'd say, well, 4 days ago we got stuck in the snow and it's a hard time getting out. I saw my awareness go into the past. Then I'd say, well, we're all right now. We're not stuck yet. I actually saw it come right to the present. And that was then one of my big hobbies. I played that game for years, when I was 7, 8, 9. And I used to have just a lot of fun worrying and bringing my awareness from the future to the present and from the past to the present by saying, I'm all right now. And that brought the whole stable consciousness of the eternity of the moment. So you see, I didn't learn yoga or meditation by reading yoga books. I've only read maybe a handful of books, and I read so slowly, I doubt if I ever got through them because I just don't read. Then that whole power of the eternity of the moment just became to get so strong with me that anything that came up in the mind, I was able to handle it, to work it out right from the now, instead of having my intelligence way off in the future and try to work it out from that perspective, or being lost in the past and trying to work it out from that perspective. And this just unfolded to me in just such a beautiful way at that early age. And these are the two experiences that stand out so vividly in my memory that they seem just like yesterday. You can work with that too. Just anytime you find yourself going into the future, going into the past, and especially when you're worried, say to yourself, I'm all right right now. And then ask yourself the question, say, aren't I? Then you'll have to answer yes. Because it hasn't happened yet. Hasn't happened yet. And probably won't. Because it can only happen to you on the physical plane if you live in the mental plane, in the area of the mind where it's affecting your emotions. Then finally it'll affect the physical emotions of your physical body, of the instinctive mind. And you'll cause it to happen on the physical plane. That's how we apparently create things. We don't really create things, but we apparently create things by putting our awareness into the mental area, and then finally it becomes manifest on the physical, or we see on the physical what we saw in the mental and experienced there. Remember that. I had a student once who was constantly afraid that I'd kick him out, and he was so afraid of it. And I didn't want to kick him out because he was so afraid of it. So finally I kicked him out. And he went through all of that, then I took him back. We all had to fulfill the law. Then from this time on, he's never been afraid of being kicked out. He found it wasn't so bad. But all the time he was afraid of being kicked out, he kicked himself out. And I had to kick him out and bring him back. So he'd get over that and be all right right now. So that's actually true. And he just worked with that. He finally just caused it to happen. He caused the situation. It's happened in several different people's lives. So shortly after, I had this experience of the eternity of the moment. My family started to pass away. My mother died. A few years later, my father died. And everybody said, what do you want to do? That was a new question. Because I didn't want to do anything. I hadn't thought about doing anything. And hadn't intended on doing anything. I was just being taken care of. And going along with what people of that age do, and I had my inner activity game being all right right now. So I thought about it and I said, I want to dance. And dance, incidentally, is the highest form of spiritual expression. That is why they used to dance in the churches and in the temples. In the ancient culture, it's the highest form of spiritual expression and the fastest way to your enlightenment is to get acquainted with the movements of the currents of the physical body, the emotional body, and the spiritual body. And just like the Om, the awe of the Om correlates the physical body, the Ooh correlates the intellectual body. And brings through the soul. So does the dance, inspired by the music, moving the currents of the physical body, releases awareness into inner realms very smoothly, very quickly, and very systematically. So then my life started to just unfold. One of the friends of my family was a marvelous dancer, my very first catalyst. And this catalyst studied in India, all the Indian forms of dance. Studied in France, the various pre-classic forms of dance and studied all the ancient Greek forms of dance. And I started studying. But more than that, my first training in meditation began with this catalyst who had studied in India for over 5 years, studied all the laws of yoga and meditation and various forms of mysticism. And I visited the catalyst about twice a week, and then all summer, every summer, for 4 years, just on a regular basis. And I was learning how the inner energies moved through the nerve system and out through the physical body. I was taught how, when you listen to music, the music first moves the inner currents of the body, and then lastly, because of those responses, you move the physical body. And the body was getting exercised and trained, and I was learning concentration. Being one-pointed, holding awareness in one place for given length of time. I was learning pranayama, diaphragmatic breathing, and the control of the breath, all at that time, at that early age. And I wasn't supposed to ask any questions. I just went for my training, got my training. That's what I wanted to do. That's what I had decided to do. And went away, practiced what was given to me to do. Went back, got more, practiced. Later I was trained to be a teacher, to teach other students the same way, about 12 years of age. And then finally, I had absorbed almost everything. And one summer, I met my next catalyst. One catalyst introduced me to the next, and who took over training, also in the dance. But in the next phase of the whys and wherefores of mysticism, I was taught exactly how the physical body goes to sleep and how you leave the physical body in the astral body, leave the astral body, turn around, look at the physical body, which is connected by a silver cord. I was taught how the inner energies of the chakra system work, along with the movements of the physical body inspired by different types of music. I was given tremendous training in just a free expression of the movement of the body without being inhibited, which broke up the whole emotional area. There are a lot of people today that are just getting into that. They just start moving as they feel like moving. And this catalyst taught how to center the whole being of the physical body, the emotional body, as well as the spiritual body, so that the inner light began to appear. And I had my first inner light experiences about 13, 14, 15 years old. I was with this catalyst for 2 years, and finally, I, in a sense, graduated and was introduced to my next catalyst that I was with for about 4 years. My third catalyst had a marvelous training, a very disciplined training, from a Swami from the island of Ceylon that was 4 years in America in the 1930s. And he gave a very powerful training to this catalyst, as well as quite a few other people in the United States. And his method of teaching was that something also they're doing today, that whatever was wrong with you, he'd just tell you straight. And then he would put his students in meditation, walk away. And if they weren't in meditation when he came back, he wouldn't have anything more to do with them. And just cut them short just like that. So in studying along with my third catalyst, I went twice a week and regularly for a couple of years, never asked any questions. I was just obeyed what was told to me, because I was taught at a very early age. When I first went to the second catalyst, I was told, you have to absorb inner teachings. And you just absorb the inner teachings, and then they awaken within you, and you complement them by your own inner knowing. So I knew that, man, don't ask any questions. You just take what's going to be given to you and be very grateful because of it. And immediately I started on an entirely different form of training. The ultimate goal of self-realization was really fired up in me as the thing to be after in this life. I was taught all the psychology of the vibratory rate of different colors and how to read auras and what each color meant within the aura itself and how to see auras and how to understand human nature, the way people think, the way people act. And again, I went to this catalyst about twice a week and never asked any questions. Just did what I was told to do and meditated on the different studies. At that time, I was meditating 2 hours a day, every day, right on the clock, sitting just without moving and going in on all of these various intricate inner things. In the study of color and the vibratory rate of color and the understanding of the nature of people, I was shown very, very carefully. We took about a year to understand, to learn to intuitively understand the actions and reactions of people by how they move. This is a continuation of the arts. So you'd actually know by how somebody moved their hand, or somebody eating, how they would move and handle their fork. You know all the inner attitudes that they carried and how they lived. And you'd actually be able to see the condition of their apartment at home just by how they walk. I was trained and watched people walking and see just what type of nature they are, how quick they would be to anger, how quick they'd be to become jealous, whether they were candidates for the path or whether they weren't candidates for the path. Then I had my first training in testing students as to whether they were mystically inclined or whether they weren't mystically inclined. And this took another year. Then we went into the study of thought forms and the various colors of a thought form. So that by the color of a thought form, which you would see through an inner faculty, you know what the person was thinking and the mood that they were in while they were thinking it. And we worked on this very, very intricately, just for long hours. Then I had a very thorough training of the inner beings who are living within the superconscious realms of the mind, some with physical bodies and some without physical bodies, helping mankind in their spiritual quest the very same way a mother and father overshadow the child and helping the child mature physically as well as emotionally. And this was a very intricate training that we went into just very, very thoroughly. Then finally, I was introduced to my next teacher. And all of this time, I can't remember having ever asked a question or entered into a discussion. I remember when just once something wasn't quite clear to me and I wanted to discuss it. And I was cut short with, there'll be no discussion. And after that, I went away and I thought, why did I ever open my mouth and break the vibration there? Because it immediately became clear to me. I had just missed a sentence in the what was being told to me. I missed a couple of words. But in a few minutes, they all came back on the playback. This is the way mystics are trained. There's no discussion. There's no questions. They are there to work it out on the inside. And there's plenty of help on the inside which enables them to do that, to develop those inner faculties. My next teacher was a Swami, took me to the island of Ceylon. I studied the Swami for a year and a half and was taught how to use the willpower to get things done in the material world. And he had me doing all sorts of things, putting in bridges for villages that the bridge had been washed out and nobody cared whether they had the bridge or not, go to the proper people to in government to get the funds to put in the bridge. He gave me a project to take a survey of all the carpenters in a certain area on the island of Ceylon who were using saws like this. You know, just the hand saws. Every carpenter in Ceylon was using hand saws. And I had to go around with a little notebook, write down their names and addresses and the type of saws that they had. My assignment was to supply all of those carpenters with electric saws, the rotating type of saw. You know, the bandsaw that goes real fast. And this was so foreign to me. I didn't know how to do things like that at all. And you put on a record and I could really show you how to dance, but I didn't even know about saws and things of that nature. Anyway, I went around with my little notebook because by that time I had pretty well understood you don't ask any questions. And I couldn't stand people speaking sharply to me anyway, so I didn't ask any questions. I went around. And then he said, well, have they gotten their bandsaws yet? And I said, well, I'm working on it. So I drew up a big proposal and it just came to me what to do next. Then I gave it to him. He said, now what you should do with this, you should go to Mr. So-and-so of some department in the government. And you give it to him and you sit down and you tell him about how fast work is done in your country. And so I did. And it started action. They all woke up to the fact that there was a different kind of saw to use. And they imported one. And 5 years later, every carpenter now has these new saws. One assignment like that after another. And he worked on the philosophy that you do what you're told, and if you're given an assignment to do, don't come back unless you finish it. That was the end of that. You just didn't come back to him unless you finished it. And you were to use your willpower, and you were to use your own inner intelligence to complete your assignment. And that was it. And if you didn't know how, he said, just om. And I used to say, I want to go into a cave and meditate. He said, there's plenty of time to go into a cave to meditate. Cave's inside of you. And I said, well, I had come to Ceylon to find my guru. Because it had been so impressed on me that you have to have a guru. And I'd come to find my guru and to meditate. And it was also impressed on me that a cave was a very good place to meditate in. And I wanted to find the self, to realize the self. And I felt I could do it. I felt if I could just get a little quiet enough, just give me a little bit of time, I would do that. Because I was a very positive person at time. I still am. Plenty of time to meditate. What you have to do next is go and get an ashram established up here for these Buddhist children because their school is falling apart. And then I'd be sent up to some Buddhist temple and their school and the priests were all sitting around, the school's falling apart. And he said, you just sit there and meditate and they'll see you meditating. And then I'd sit there and meditate every day, live in the Buddhist temple. And then all the kids from all the villages would come around to see me sit and meditate. And then the priest would get all the kids into classes and that would start the school back up again. And then he would get government funds to build him a building because he'd go tell the government there's 600 kids there and they don't have a building. And then the government would send in professional teachers and a school would be going. I think the only thing that I ever made a suggestion was that I wanted to go to a cave to meditate. And that got cut off very, very sharply. Well, finally, this Swami went to Europe and I was alone in Ceylon and I was taken to a cave to meditate. And I met my next teacher, who is a Muslim priest. And this priest was a wonderful man. He never took a bath. And he always looked as if he had just gotten out of the bathtub. And he was so pure, he just smelled clean. And we had a wonderful meeting. When he saw me, he said, I had a dream about you. And he pulled out a little book. He said, I wrote it down. And I said, funny thing, he said, I had a dream about you too. And I had written it down. I was writing down my dreams at that time. And he said it was full moon and we compared dates. We had written down the same dream at the same time about our meeting on the inner plains. And he started giving me a wonderful training about the use of the third eye. The intricate use and development of the third eye. He'd take me out and we'd meditate together on these windy, windy cliffs. And he'd make me sit up so straight and the wind would just be blowing. And then he'd say, now it was dead night. Now did you see this? And did you see that? And he was involved in a form of mysticism as taught in the Quran. And he shared all of that with me. And I learned some extremely valuable things about the use of the third eye and the psychic unfoldment using the faculties of the soul, which later came in extremely handy and very valuable for my work even today. I really appreciate him. And we made a pilgrimage to these caves where he lived. He's now since passed. On my last trip to Ceylon, all of us were there just about a month ago. Then I went back all by myself and I was bound and determined to meditate in this cave and realize the self, get the ultimate. And I had a magnificent training all along the path. I had gone through all the different inner areas. Each catalyst, it helped me to the next one and helped me through all the different inner stages, developing the memory faculties, one point in this concentration, meditation faculties, the willpower, the cognition faculties, the seeing everything from your inner perspective, looking at the world as if you're the center of the universe. But there was just one thing lacking, and that was the ultimate goal. So I approached the caves of Jelani with absolutely nothing. I had given all my money away to the villagers along the way. I didn't take any food. I'd given all my clothes away, everything, and I just went there. And I said to myself, I'm going to fast until I find this realization that I wanted. And I started to do that. There wasn't anybody there. At the time, and I went up in the caves and I started to meditate. And I meditated and I meditated and went in and in and in and in and in and finally realized the whole thing. And then villagers who had seen me going up to the caves came up and they had brought food and all sorts of things. We had a great big feast. They'd come all the way up from the valley. The caves are on a big 400-foot cliff, which drops straight down into the valley below. And then people started coming, and I returned back to civilization. This is way deep in the jungle with a Muslim man who came up, and he taught me Muslim chanting on the way back. And from this Muslim priest, I met the next priest. And I had a wonderful vision of a tremendous peacock tail. And in Hindu mysticism, the peacock is the bird that the Lord Subramanyam rides on through the heavens. And I saw this beautiful peacock tail, just like looking on television with my eyes closed. The next morning, I met my next teacher, who took me into Hinduism. And on the inner planes, I began meeting all the different Hindu gods and deities. And he taught me all of the esoteric Hinduism. Hinduism is the oldest, it's the root religion of the world. Everyone was a Hindu at one time or another in their past lives. And Hinduism is a combination and collection of the teachings, practices of thousands of gurus all along the way through the centuries. No one knows how old Hinduism is. And it has systems and teachings that, if you got into it, is more complicated than the most complicated computer of today. And yet, after realization of the self, it's as simple as kindergarten. And I was introduced to the esoterics of the Hindu temple worship and why they ring the bells, why they blow the horns, why the priests do what they do, why they wear the sacred ashes on their forehead, and all the whys and hows. And I became so sensitive to the vibration of the astrological signs, the vibrations that they make on the earth. When the stars make certain formations, then a certain Hindu deities are worshipped at that time, which are certain faculties within yourself, which is the deity, which come to life at that time. And I was so sensitive that I could tell exactly what deity would be worshipped at what temple. And when the service would be, and I'd say, come on, we have to go to the service real fast because so-and-so, Ganesha or Subramanyam or Vishnu is being worshipped today at the temple. This really, really interested this teacher, who's living today in Ceylon, and now he's one of the priests of our order today. He later was in charge of the ashram that I founded in Ceylon. So we went from temple to temple to temple, and he unfolded all of the esoterics of Hinduism that you do not read in books, you do not find in books. It's passed down from father to son, father to son, father to son. And finally I said, I want to be a Hindu. I feel like I'm a Hindu more than anything because I have all this inner unfoldment. And how can you arrange it? I said, I want to be taken in by a very pure priest. And it finally happened. He said, well, there aren't any. You know, there aren't any priests, in a sense, with realization like you talk about. And I said, I just think it's going to work out. And I had no idea in those days of teaching or being a guru or anything of that nature. And all I was doing was going within and going within further, and then after that going within further and further and further. And I had a good start. I had gotten my samadhi. I had all the foundation work of how to do it again and again and again, and I was perfectly content in my inner life. So finally this priest taught me just about everything I needed to know and introduced me to the next great, wonderful master who ordained me. That was Jnanaguru Yoganathan, who is affectionately known by the people of the area as Yogaswami. This man was a magnificent man. No one approached him but what they were in the right mood when they approached him. They were literally afraid of him. And when you got into the radius of where he was, the whole atmosphere was just scintillating. You just felt electricity in the atmosphere. And you just felt like being your very best self, you know, and having everything just right inside of you. And people would prepare themselves to go and see him and just to take him a little bit of fruit. They'd prepare themselves for 3 or 4 days. They'd say, well, I'm not quite ready yet to see Guru Yoganathan. Maybe tomorrow, or I'll go on maybe a very auspicious day. Because he didn't want him to look through them and point out something that they thought he might see. And he'd just do that too. He always knew when people were coming to him before they got there. So my meeting with him was very different. I was introduced. He said, come on in and sit down. Everybody else prostrates. You prostrate in the Orient in front of a guru. You get down on your hands and knees and face your full body on the floor. He said, you come in and sit down. Then he started asking me the deepest philosophical questions that you'd ever want to be asked. And I gave the right answer each time. As soon as he asked the question, I gave the answer. I don't know. The answer just came from the superconscious. You know, I just give the answer and ask another question and give another answer and ask another question and give another answer. Finally, I guess he ran out of questions. And then he gave me the name of Subramanyam. And I accepted it. I thought it was just nice, you know, because I had been so deep in Hindu mysticism. And to me, it really meant something. Subra means the light that emanates out from just the central source. It just emanates out. Munya comes from the Sanskrit word muni, which means a teacher or someone. Muni just speaks out from intuition without any forethought, any intellect or anything. He just speaks out from a nothingness into a something. And so I was very happy about that. And we had just a wonderful meeting. He treated me just like a brother in a sense. And it didn't surprise me, because I wasn't in that consciousness of being surprised, but it surprised everybody else. He made me eat food and everything. And after we left, everyone started to be different to me. And I told him, I said, I have established an ashram in Alavati. I said, we'd like your blessings. He says, fine, good. It's going to be a 3-story building one day. You're going out in the world. You're going to feed thousands of people. You're going to build palaces. And he started giving me all these different instructions. And he said, now you'll return back to America and you'll go back and you'll roar. And when you come back here, nothing will be gained and nothing will be lost. He said, now you go and teach the realizations that you've had. I was used to being told what to do, you know, especially by people on the path and my different teachers along the way. So I thought, well, fine. And meeting a great person like this to take a personal interest in you is really wonderful. Then I went back again. And we had a beautiful time together, and we meditated together in a beautiful flow. Then went back the third time. And this time, he got up and we had a wonderful flow, nice, beautiful talk. And he gave me as I was leaving, the hardest slap on the back that you'd ever want to receive from anybody. He just reached up and cracked me on the back. It was just tremendous, you know. If I wasn't tall and if I were short, I would have fallen flat on my face. I really would. If I weren't so tall, I would have just sort of crumbled under it. All the Hindus around, they were just startled. because that's one of the most powerful. And then he gave me some very powerful instructions. And they were just startled because that is the way that a guru, with a slap on the back, especially a slap on the back, but even the Hindus say just a touch with the intent from a guru of that caliber, who's a moksha guru, of one who just lives in these inner states all the time. And he was trained by a guru who lives in these states all the time. That type of recognition transmits spiritual powers and tremendous knowledge. There are four ways that a guru will initiate or ordain. One is through talking, and that's very mild. One is through a look, and then one through thought. And then the most powerful is through touch, with the actual inner power. And then through that contact, then he starts to transmit all of his inner knowing to the person that he initiates. And I really got a crack on the back and very, very powerful instructions from him. And then all the knowledge about how to be a guru and all of this began to unfold in me from him, then from his guru, and then from his guru's guru. So you have a whole line of gurus there. So then I returned, followed his instructions, returned to America, and settled down to unfolding more, and was given instructions that I wasn't supposed to do anything here until I was 30, except observe and have experiences and learn. And then when I was 30, my students would start to come. And it happened just that way. When I was 30, my students started to come around me, and for the sake of keeping everybody so they wouldn't bump into one another, we had special days for beginning students and special days for students that had been with me a little longer, and we got a building so we wouldn't get wet in the rain. And that's how our temple and Waialua University got started here in America in 1957, about 10 years later. Right after my ordination under Yogaswami, the whole book Cognizant Ability began to unfold in a very beautiful way, Gems of Cognition, and then later the Self-God, which you all had and have read. When I first started teaching, it was only because a small group of devotees asked me to do so. They all gathered around me and they said, "When are you going to start teaching?" I said, "Right now." We met the next day and had a marvelous class. I told them, "I'll be with you for 3 months, and I shall observe how well you do. If you are consistent and you do what I tell you to do, then we'll continue." They did. And they did so well the first 3 months, and we started for another 3 month session. Finally, the devotees asked me to remain in San Francisco, and I said, "Fine, I will." Then the students put together the first master course, which started our textbooks for the school, and which was sent to many, many thousands of students for the last 15 years. Then I was surprised about 6 years ago when Yogaswami passed away, and I started getting letters from Ceylon saying, "You have to come back now because we need you as the guru here." And I thought, well, here I am here in the West, you know, and I didn't quite understand. So then I decided to go back because I always do what I'm told from my inner self. And this came in that same vibration of my training. So that's how the last Indian Odyssey got formed, with my desire to go back to Ceylon. I took 64 students with me. We went back to Ceylon. And then I've been back again since, once last March. And then I just returned from there. It's my third trip. And the people are so wonderful. They say, well, Master Subramunya and Jnana Guru Yoganathan, they're just one. And now we have to listen to what he has to say. And they come to the ashram regularly, and they're going along. And some of them are starting to unfold very nicely. They're starting to study Shum. And they'll be starting to study this Tieshum that you're studying now. They're studying it there now, some of them, and the vibration is getting picked up where he left it off. He was a different kind of a guru than I am. He had everybody afraid of him because he was very sharp and very abrupt. If there were someone that he didn't like, he'd throw something at them. And after my ordination with him and the instructions that he gave me, I was on my way. I had my mission for this life. He had given it to me. He had recognized all of the training that I had since I started being trained at 9 years old. He had recognized all that training and attainment and all, and he just put the final stamp on it. That was it. And after that experience of that slap on the back, I went back one other time. See him, because I wanted to be with him, you know. He was sitting in meditation, just like that picture. He would never allow anyone to take his picture, but a little child snapped that one that's in our temple there. You see him sitting in meditation? He was sitting just like that. And he looked at me, and he shut his eyes, and he said, "I'm not at home." You just don't ask people like that questions or make any comments at all. You try to get out as fast as you can. And I didn't get out fast enough. And he said, "I said I am not at home." So, but he worked right along with me, I discovered, my last trip to Ceylon and the one before that. He worked right along with me through the years, by training the son of Father Kandaya, who was the priest I studied with. He trained him for 6 years to work with me to manage the ashram in Ceylon. And he said, "Now I'm training you and I don't want you to tell anybody. Keep it a secret because other people get jealous." And he trained him and worked with him. Of course, other people did know he was being trained, and broke up all of his fear patterns, habit patterns, and he works right along with us at this point, just like one of our advanced monks work along with me, just very, very smooth, and he's very sharp, and he's very different than the people of the country. We'll be bringing him here. His name is Vinayagamurthy Chettiar, and he'll be coming to America for an orientation through all of our centers here, probably in the spring. And the time that in 1957, do you remember I told you that big inner body sort of took over the physical body? He went around announcing to everybody in Jaffna at that time that I was dead. And he had everybody believing that I was dead that time. And, well, it was the last of the external self that died, the last of the astral body. Finally, in realization, the inner body takes over the astral body, and it doesn't work anymore, doesn't function anymore. So you see how a great master like that can work on the inner planes in a very vibrant and very dynamic way. And he's working on the inner planes now, as well as his guru. And with you all, helping you in your meditations, clearing up blind spots, and all very, very actively, very dynamically. You might even see them in your dreams sometimes. The people of Ceylon, of that area, see me in their dreams and see them in their dreams at night. Those are times when you go into inner planes of your psyche, your body, of your soul. You learn and study from the inside out. Since, as I will remind you again, the path of the mystic is two-thirds within and only one-third on the outside. The quieter the mystic becomes on the outside, the more active he is in working in inner realms with either his students or others. One doesn't decide to be a guru. It's something that comes along through evolution. And that's what happened to me. So you can look right back to that very, very first experience that I can remember, this great soul and this little baby that he was incarnating into. And then the next experience of finding that eternity of the moment. Then the mother dying, who is finally reincarnated and is with me today. And it was one of the monks in this order. Then the father dying and is reincarnated today, studying to be a minister, but not in this order, in another one. And then coming along, learning the art of the dance, the movement of the body, which takes us right into the movement of all the psychic bodies. And coming along, then being given tests to strengthen the willpower. Test that if you failed, you just didn't come back. That was it for this life, period. And it was a very clear understanding. I was always taught in stories. And most of my teachers would tell me stories about the unfortunate student that was given something to do and failed. And wasn't it just too bad because they had really a lot of potential, but they didn't do their assignments, so they came back and I just didn't even open the door. Why bother about people like that, you know? Then they went around the corner and called me up on the telephone. And as soon as I recognized it was their voice, I just put my finger on the little thing and cut them off as smoothly as possible. That's the inner teaching's not for them if they couldn't do a simple assignment like that. I was given these stories, which really made sense to me. Most mystical teaching is taught in indirection, is indirectly given. It's not taught directly. It's taught indirectly. Therefore, the mystically inclined person will catch it. And the one who's not mystically inclined won't. A mystic could talk to 40 people in a room, only 10 of which would be two-thirds within, the rest would be two-thirds out, and each one would hear him saying something different because all the inner teaching is done in an indirect way. And that's the way I was taught as I came along. The Waialua University of Contemplative Arts teaching format, more than ever before, is going to be very close to my particular training for that set the pattern. And our catalysts and ministers are trained to teach in that particular way as well. So this then now sets pattern for you. You know me better and my inner life and how I live it better. And tomorrow, when we get together, we'll start unscrambling all of this that I've been saying today. I've really socked it to you. And we're going to now take it all apart. And we must remember that anything of a psychic experience, psychism is the faculties of the soul. And anything of a psychic nature, psyche means soul, or the development of inner faculties that can record and make sense out of vibratory rates, which come through the ethers. In the very same way, our ears, our taste faculties, our sense of touch, and our eyes record and make sense out of various vibratory rates. The vibration of my voice, you are hearing it. Your innate intelligence, your awareness, pure intelligence makes sense out of it. And our other faculties within us, which are called psychic faculties or faculties of the soul, pick up yet a more refined rate of vibration. And then we learn how to translate that into knowledge. We learn the language of the soul, just like you all learn the English language. Some of you know other languages that don't make sense to us who do not know those languages. And you can read those vibrations. You can read the vibrations of French and of Spanish. I can't read the vibrations of French and Spanish. In the very same way, if you're psychically awakened, your inner sight, your inner hearing is awakened, you can read vibrations just like a radio or a television can pick up the vibrations going through the atmosphere because it is organized in such a way to do that. And this is a very vital and very necessary training for the mystic. And I was fortunate enough, just through my evolution, to come from catalysts to ministers to priests to guru to master, and that started me on my mission and brings me to where I am today, doing nothing. Just doing nothing. Watching the pattern repeat itself time and time again, as my Natye come through their unfoldment in Wailua University of Contemplative Arts, going from one catalyst to another under my watchful eye, and finally one day I too will give a slap on the back to 1, 2, 3, 6, 7, 15, whatever, and send fine gurus out into the world on their mission, just doing nothing. They'll have the feeling of being in one place. Everything happening around them as they watch the cycles of life flow one into another. Just watching, watching, watching.